Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. If you would take your seats, I'd appreciate it. I'm going to try to clip this onto my belt without disassembling myself. I see one of my former public affairs officers out in the audience. I'll embarrass the hell out of him this morning, but that's okay. Won't be the first time. On behalf of Dr. John Hamry, our president and CEO, I want to welcome you to the Center for Strategic International Studies. This is another in the ongoing series of our military strategy fora. Most of us call them forums rather than fora. I never took Latin, but the church tried to teach it to me when I was a young man. Our series is underwritten by a generous support from Rolls-Royce North America, and we're very grateful to Rolls-Royce for that. This series has been going on for quite a number of years now. We've had quite a host of distinguished speakers come through. And this morning's is actually a very interesting continuation of one that we had a couple years ago, just almost 2 years ago. General Haughton was here to roll out the initial results of the strategic defense and strategy review that the United Kingdom undertook for all of its forces. And today we'll follow from that with a more focused description and an evolution in that regard. I would also like to welcome our viewers on the web. You don't have to pay attention to the next request, but for those in the room, I would ask that you would silence your cell phones and other electronic devices so that they will maintain that silence through the course of the morning. We're also going to follow a little bit of a different regime this morning with respect to the way in which we solicit and engage questions from the audience as we get to the end of our process. I believe that you all have or will have access to note cards. Are there note cards on the table? Handed them out. You've got all you need. You have a complete stockpile. Excellent. Even better. You can write down questions as you go. You can wait until the end and write them down. We'll collect the questions with the staff in the room, so all you have to do whenever you've got a question written down is hold up your card. I would ask you to wait until the end of General Carter's remarks to do that, but we'll collect them all, and the questions then will be combined and integrated and solidified by Dr. Steve Flanagan and Nate Fryer, our senior fellows here, who are going to direct questions and put you on the spot, shall we speak. So, with that, I'm really pleased to introduce General Nicholas Carter, Lieutenant General Nicholas Carter, who has had quite a distinguished career in the British Army. He's had service in the Balkans. He's had service in Afghanistan. He's had service in Iraq. He's one of those who was actually in Afghanistan before Iraq and then got to repeat that. But he's coming off what may have been, in some ways, the most unique and challenging assignment of a distinguished career. For the last year, he's been in charge of designing and, I guess now, handing off the review of the Army called Army 2020, and it's the future of the British Army. Most of you know that here in America, we watch the British very carefully because they're usually 2 or 3 years ahead of us in innovative ideas, and we watch them because, first of all, we generally end up following them. Secondly, we like to watch and see what dead ends they go down, and then we hope we can avoid them, although I think our history is we tend to pursue them and say, were they really that dead of an end? And let's see if we can collapse in that regard. But it's important not just because of the lessons learned. It's important because of the special relationship that America has with the United Kingdom. And that relationship has been solidified and exemplified by the last decade of operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And I think we're now at a unique time in the history of this because of the potential for dramatic declining resources across the Western world. The future of that relationship will be tested and has to be strengthened in ways not only associated with resources, but also with alliances. The unique relationship with the United States and the United Kingdom, of course, I think will remain forever. There's almost no way you can break that. I can't envision a circumstance other than an alien invasion in which that would happen. But there's also an important relationship that Britain has with Europe, with the rest of Europe. And the future of the rest of Europe and its military is perhaps in even greater risk because of resources than here in our own country and in your country itself. And it's a very difficult task to say, at the same time, you have to become closer and more integrated with America, but you also have to be a beacon and a guidepost for the continent. And that's a very challenging and demanding task. And of course, one of the places in which that task is the most demanding and the most challenging are ground forces and the Army. And so I think that puts a context, if you will. We're going to ask General Carter to take as much time as he wants explaining the world as he sees it and how it's going to go. And then I'll probably pose a couple questions to you from here, then we'll throw it open. So be thinking of that. With that, sir, I'll turn the microphone over to you.
No, well, thank you very much for those kind words and introduction. And it's a great honor and privilege to be here amongst you today. I actually put this thing down about 8 weeks ago, which was a great relief, as you'll hear why in a moment. And I'm now preparing to go back to Afghanistan, and I take over as DECOM ISAF on the 9th of October, which I'm looking forward to. And I've had the privilege of attending your pinnacle course during the course of the last 3 or 4 days. So I've had another injection of what it is to serve alongside your great nation. So thank you very much for having me here this morning. I'm going to talk about Army 2020, as we described it. And 2020 is a very relevant point, which I'll come back to, because I think when you look at your Joint Force 2020 as well, there's a reason why we've pitched a decade out, and I'll come back to that. But as has been set out, in 2010, so a couple of years ago, we conducted a strategic defence and security review. And the upshot of that, I think, was a sort of process of evolution. Because by around March or April of the following year, so 4 months later, it was increasingly becoming apparent that the nature of the fiscal situation and, in fact, the attitude pan-government about how the nation might want to fight its wars in the future called into question the size of the army in relation to what the Strategic Defence and Security Review had posited. And the upshot of all of that was that an exercise conducted in the Ministry of Defence concluded that our army should be reduced by around 20%. So it was going to fall from a figure of fractionally over 100,000 down to 80,000. Now, what was interesting was that a separate piece of work had been conducted in parallel with this essentially economic exercise by Nick Horton, the Vice Chief of Defence, General Sir Nick, but he did it not as the Vice Chief of the Defence Staff, but as Sir Nick Horton, into the future of our reserves. Now, this particular piece of work recommended that in an age of austerity, and for other very good reasons that I'll come back to, we weren't probably making enough use of our reserves going forwards. We'd used a lot of individuals in the reserves during the intense combat operations that we conducted in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we perhaps hadn't got out of the reserves the capability that we needed in the future. So this piece of work, known as Future Reserves 20, was conflated with this savings exercise, and I was essentially handed a problem on July the 18th of last year by the Chief of our General Staff, our Chief of Staff, to work out how we could take this significant reduction in the regular strengths, these very good ideas that were coming forward on the reserves, and how we could come forward with effectively a new army. Now, when you have a cut of that magnitude, you can't simply, as we say in Europe, salami slice any longer. It calls you to have to go back and look at things from first principles. And I think probably the last time that we did this in that context was in 1957, when we radically overhauled our structure. We got rid of conscription and national service, and we went to the all-volunteer force that you know and recognise as well. Now, we had a series of events in 91 and then 97 when we examined our structure again. But on each of those occasions, I think the architects of 1957 would have recognised the shape of the army that emerged. And it was very much an army that was sliced a little further, but hadn't gone back to first principles. So, first principles. Now, that meant that the approach that I was going to adopt needed to be a slightly different approach. And I was also very conscious in this era of freedom of information and the fact that if you're going to reduce an army by 20%, in the British Army in particular, you're going to get into a lot of difficult ground to do with regimental structures and the future of kilts and all of these sorts of paraphernalia, which means so much to the sort of political spectrum out in the shires, that it was going to be necessary, really, for this not to be played out in the public space. And what we fundamentally didn't need was the politicians and the government who are ultimately going to have to decide on whether we were doing the right thing to be exposed and to see all of the newspapers arguing about the relative strengths of the Royal Irish Regiment versus the 2nd Battalion of the Scottish Regiment or whatever else it might be. So the way we played it was with an extremely small team, and we committed virtually nothing to paper, which will surprise you. The Army Board, what's now known as our Army Command Group, which is the sort of top eight key players at the top of the army, chaired by the Chief of General Staff, met every 3 or 4 weeks to consider the proposals that we were coming forward with. And on each of those occasions, they received no pre-briefing. They were taken through a series of scenarios and decision briefs by me using handouts. And at the end of each meeting, the handouts were all taken in. And the whole thing was conducted over a period of about 16 to 25 weeks on the basis of this very secure, very watertight system, which meant that almost throughout the process, we had virtually no speculation, and there was nothing put out there which in any way compromised our position, nor indeed made it awkward for the political decisions that subsequently had to be made as the piece of work began to culminate during the course of April and May. Now, of course, that's a dangerous approach to take on occasions, because, of course, what you also need to do if you want to do genuine reform is you actually need to take the generation that matters with you. And, of course, if you're reforming an army, it's not old farts like me who are going to be living with the implications of all of this. It's people who are a lot younger than anybody in this room at the moment. It's those who've yet to join and those who are probably under 30. So what I did a lot of with my small team was to conduct what I would call focus group activity at the staff colleges and at Sandhurst, and with a generation that frankly will have to implement, execute and live with the decisions that the top of the army and the politicians were going to make. So having that dialogue and making sure that any good ideas could be bottled up, passed around and incorporated in the process, I think is also extremely important. And that's what we tried to do. Now 2020, why did we pick 2020 as an aiming point? I think first of all, I think it's tangible. I think you can sort of feel what the world might look like in 2020. But also, it's sufficiently far away for vested interest to be suspended. And you'll know that the British Army is a great tribal structure. And what you've got to try and do if you're going to try and reorganise the tribes, as you know many of us have tried to do in Afghanistan for the last few years, is you've got to suspend vested interest. And therefore, being 10 years out was quite a good aiming point, because it meant that vested interest could, to some significant degree, be suspended. So that gives you a sort of sense of the context and the background. And going back to this point about first principles, our starting point was to go back and examine the purpose of our army. Not because we disagreed with what the Strategic Defence and Security Review required of the army, but more importantly, because we wanted to look forward 10 years and we wanted to take a view on what that purpose should be in the future. Because there was another very important thing that was occurring in that time frame, and that is that the army was going to be repatriated from Germany. And we've had for many years now a large proportion of the army serving in Germany. And the view now is that by 2020, 2025, all of that army will be repatriated from Germany and will be home-based. And we will not have a great deal of overseas garrisons in the future. I'll come back to that because there are a few. But in essence, 90% of the army will be UK-based. And that's an important factor. So going back to this core purpose, my starting point was to draw a Venn diagram of three rings, if you can imagine three rings in a Venn diagram. And I'll come back to why a Venn diagram is relevant in a moment. And I populated each of those rings with the following. Top left-hand side, I described it as contingent capability for defence and deterrence. And I'll come back to that, but in essence, that's the easy bit that all armies need to be able to do. The next ring over top right, which was new, was what I called overseas engagement and capacity building, what you call security assistance. And I think this is extremely important for all sorts of reasons, which I'll come back to. And then the final ring at the bottom is what I described as UK, United Kingdom engagement, and homeland resilience. And that is obviously very relevant given the way the world's moved on, but also this fact that we were going to be predominantly UK-based in the future. So just to unpack each of those rings in turn. And I'll start with the one that I think is relatively straightforward, which is the business of contingent capability. And the first question that we asked ourselves was, in doctrinal terms, what should our contingent capability be focused on? What was going to be the upcoming nature of warfare? And what we chose to do was to look at, if you like, the sort of spectrum of hybrid opponents. One end of the spectrum, we clearly acknowledged that we would have what I would call state-sponsored hybrid. You then have, at the other end of the spectrum, what I would call the non-state regular, the sort of opponent that we're up against in Afghanistan. And way over on the other side, you've got what I would call the state non-peer. Now, our view was it was the state-sponsored hybrid, which would be the hardest threat that our army would need to face in the future. It's much the same as what the Israelis encountered, perhaps in 2006. So it's a mixture in hybrid terms of that Afghan-type threat and with the sort of equipment that you might find with a state near-peer competitor. So focused on that center point. And there's some quite important deductions that we drew from that in terms of force development. And I'll just go through the list of what we think we needed to do to reform the army in order to be able to meet that threat, taking account of the lessons that we've learned from current operations against that non-regular threat, and also being cognizant of the nature of the state versus state near-peer competitor. First of all, and a big lesson I think that we've learned from Afghanistan, is the importance of trying to separate the strategic level from the tactical level. Really challenging in modern warfare because of the nature of the strategic corporal and the way in which those levels get compressed. But what we've done in Afghanistan, with a few exceptions, predominantly when I was with Regional Command South in 2010, is that we have tended to command the brigade level of operations, very much the tactical level of operations, directly from the strategic level. Now, of course, our brigades have always been part, and particularly since 2009, of the ISAF-NATO command structure. But the extent to which, nationally, interest has been shown from the strategic level down to the brigade level had, up until 2009, been extremely intense. Now, separating the strategic from the tactical and having, frankly, the two-star level of command in between it, we believed, as an army, was absolutely fundamental. So the divisional level of operations, that level of operations, which is probably the level of operations where operational art is first practiced and is the level that separates strategic from tactical with a connection to the operational level, is something that we felt was absolutely fundamental in terms of our core design principle. Now, the next big force development deduction that played into our force structure was our belief that armoured infantry, based upon our warrior platform, much like your Bradley platform, would be the piece of kit that would stand us in good stead in the future. So we were going to build our forces around the armoured infantry battalion. But what we weren't going to do was to ignore the use of armour in all of this. And there's been much talk about the tank and the future of the tank and all of that. And our sense is that there's absolutely a future for the tank, looking 10 years hence. But it's probably not in great sort of armoured manoeuvre type capability. It's much more about close integration with infantry and engineers in small combined arms teams to achieve that overmatch effect in complex terrain. And therefore, we've reorganised our armoured regiments in a way that they are more likely to be able to integrate and battle group with the armoured infantry to deliver this small combined arms team manoeuvre element, which is, we think, the sort of structure that will be required to manage the challenges of the complex terrain and the nature of the threat that I described earlier. The next bit, which I think is very important, and it's a huge lesson that we've pulled out of Afghanistan and Iraq, is what I would call institutionalizing the idea of soft effect in our maneuver. We, as military people, have traditionally been pretty good, I think, at integrating the three dimensions, as it were, fire, movement, and the third dimension into maneuver. We are learning a great deal, aren't we, about cyber, goodness me, we've got a few steep slopes to go up in that space. But the bit that I don't think we've ever been terribly good at, and we've had to learn a lot about in Afghanistan, is the notion of the fifth dimension of maneuver, as I see it, which is inside people's minds. It's the notion of influence. And it's this idea of when you look at a problem, you start by working out what the audience is. You then have a look at the sort of effect you might want to impart upon that audience. And then you look at the methodologies from soft through to hard that are in your locker that you can use to impart that effect onto that audience. And it's that notion of five dimensions of maneuver which are absolutely critical. So integrating soft effect into what we do and the way that we maneuver is something that we have got to institutionalize if we're going to be able to compete in the sort of environment that we're talking about at the moment and maneuver genuinely in the sense of achieving advantage against our opponent. And I'll return to that in terms of structure in a moment. The next area which we've changed or adjusted the balance is between precision and suppression in respect of indirect fire. And our artillery regiments in the future will probably head towards a common caliber and an artillery system that will be able to deliver precision and suppression from the same platform. And we've done that by beginning to merge our MLRS in with our AS-90 120 platforms to try and make that something that is heading in that general direction. Broadband connectivity and the amount of points of presence on the battlefield. Again, I think a huge realization that we're probably not going to be able to resource the level of expectation that we've got on these campaigns like Afghanistan at the moment, i.e. down almost to platoon and troop level. But we have got to do a better job of being able to pass that data and the expectation that has come with it down to at least battle group level. And how that plays out in terms of our structures is interesting. And of course, it means that those in our CIS fraternity were significantly protected as we came to take regular numbers out of the structure. The ability to integrate ISR down to a much lower level, and this notion of understanding, the realization that this is a lot less about intelligence and a much bigger picture to do with information. And therefore, our intelligence core and the ability to share data that goes with it is another area that was very much ring-fenced as we took to take reductions out of the regular strength. And then the final piece, which in an age of austerity is fundamental, but also given the nature of the politics, is we need to be organized routinely for joint interagency and multinational integration. And our assumption is that the division that the British Army may or may not field in the future will be a division that will A, be able to operate in a broader multinational context, but it's got to be a division that is able to take a brigade from France or from elsewhere in the NATO alliance or from the United States of America under its command, and it's got to be able to share information and data in much the same way as we've learnt the hard way in Afghanistan. And I remember as Commander R.C. South arriving in my office in October of 2009, sitting over eight task forces and requiring seven different telephones to talk to those eight task forces. We've moved a long way with the Afghan Mission Network, which is, as you know, NATO funded, and it's the NATO system which enables us to communicate pan-ISAF. But that sort of thinking has got to be translated in how we operate in the future. And it is my sense that our divisions need to be able to do this. So that's how we see the contingent capability. The next box is the business of, the next ring, is this business of security assistance. And it's something that our great-great-grandfathers would readily have recognized. And it's where I think we've got a lot of baggage when it comes to how people perceive our colonial enterprise 150 years ago. But that said, we have got significant connections to those places that we showed an interest in the past. And it's how we perhaps use our connections and how it is that we use our reasonably well-developed ability to train indigenous forces to be able to improve capacity overseas. It's something we've done in the past and we've put degrees of effort into it, but it's not something that we've done particularly strategically or systematically. And it's our sense that we need to be doing it more strategically and more systematically. And we need to be doing it in a way that we can throw career structure at it so that we can develop people with the right cultural understanding and language within a career structure to be able to add value in East Africa or the Middle East or wherever else it might be that our national interest is over the course of the next 10 to 15 years. And equally, we want to be able to use our training facilities in the United Kingdom to bring indigenous forces over to Sandhurst or our Land Warfare Centre to be able to make the connection at home and abroad. But it is this connection, I think, which is really interesting, and it plays into the bottom circle, which is about UK engagement. Now that is, of course, important because you've got to sustain your force structure and you've got to recruit. And when I talk about reserves in a moment, you'll see exactly what I mean. But I think the bit that is interesting is that in the UK, you will find that there are significant foreign diasporas, Asians, Somalians, and so the list goes on. And it's the relationship between these minorities as diasporas and their countries at home and how we as an army playing a supporting role can connect to those communities at home and use those connections to have greater effect overseas in terms of security assistance and begin to develop the sorts of relationships and the expertise necessary to produce the sorts of outcomes that are needed in the regions themselves. And if you're going to host a conference on Somalia, you're just as likely to be able to get the sorts of people you might want to talk to in Bristol or Liverpool as you are through your mission in Mogadishu. And how you join the dots to make that happen, I think, is the place where we as an army have got a very important supporting role to be able to play. Now, importantly, what it will also do is to improve our understanding of those regions of the world where we might wish to deploy contingent forces in the future. And I think it was Antonio Gustozzi who said that every age has its follies, and the folly of our age has been an irresistible desire to change the world without first studying it and trying to understand it. And I think that should be pinned on every policymaker's wall. And I'm in no doubt that if we can develop the sort of expertise that I've described in terms of security assistance, there's a sporting chance that we might be rather better next time we do it. So the Venn diagram, the underpinning piece that takes us forward, in a sense, into how our structure is going to work. And there are a number of quite big ideas, I suppose, in terms of Army 2020. And the first big idea is the use of reserves, which is something that culturally we have not done much of in the United Kingdom. You have to go back to 1907 and Haldane's reforms when he created our territorial army. But in a sense, almost from that point onwards, there has been very little integration between the regular structure and the reserve structure. And indeed, every time that we've restructured our reserve forces, it's tended to be an afterthought after we have worked out what the regular structure is. What we did this time was we produced an integrated structure. And our starting point was to say, what is it that our reserves could do in the future? And the first thing that we concluded is that there will still be a requirement for a significant amount of specializations. And we see this at the moment with the medical profession, where it's very difficult for us as an active duty component to have the sort of expertise in medical terms that you need right across the field to be able, on a basis of regulars, to be able to deliver the outputs you need. Our hospital facilities in Afghanistan are very much manned by civilian doctors who are mobilized to provide the requirement in that sense. Now, there will be other areas where reserves will have a role to play in terms of specializations, whether it's intelligence functions, perhaps a bit of language, and certainly cyber. So, specialisms. The next area, which is a departure for us, is what I would call those capabilities that don't require a huge amount of collective training in peacetime to retain their readiness. And here, typically, you're talking about the logistic area, sustainment, and perhaps the sort of dumb gunnery skills that come with some parts of what the Royal Artillery delivers. So we reckon that was an area where we could reduce regular active component numbers and increase reserve numbers. And then the third area is very much about the sort of notion of regeneration over the longer term, and that was the combat arms, the infantry and the armoured corps. And I'll return to them, because what we wanted to do here was to develop partnerships and integrated structures. But it's important you understand the context in how we'll employ them. So, three areas. Now, the opportunity to use reserves has really fallen out of, I think for the first time in my career, defence planning assumptions that we have now that fell out of the Strategic Defence and Security Review that no longer assume that the British Army will be deployed on an enduring operation. We need to be able to do an enduring operation, an Afghanistan or a Bosnia or whatever else it might be. But the assumption now is that we will do it at readiness. And that therefore means that you can apply a principle of graduated or tiered readiness to how you get yourself embroiled in an operation or of that sort of order in the future. And that opens up the potential to look at how your force structure is able to sustain enduring operations at readiness. And that has given us the opportunity to integrate the reserve in the way that I'm about to lay out in more detail. Now, our structure, therefore, is essence is in two parts, with a sort of subsidiary part. We will have what we've called reaction forces, which are predominantly active duty, or regular as we would describe it, with probably only the requirement for about 5 or 10% reserve input. And as it says on the tin, these are forces that will be at significantly higher readiness. At the tip of the spear, three ready battle groups, one found on the back of one of the armoured infantry brigades, one found on the back of the air assault brigade, and one that we support, which is found from the commando brigade. Slightly further back, a brigade at high readiness to be able to provide one of these enduring stabilisation operations, or if needs permit, to do something rather more difficult in terms of complexity. And all of this in a divisional context. And we're leaning very much into the belief that if you're going to deploy something of this sort of order at the brigade level, it must have a divisional piece above it to provide the value added and the wisdom that I described earlier in terms of the separation from the strategic and the tactical level, but also to bring the enablers that will be necessary to make this happen. Now, the enablers are interesting, and they will be provided by an organisation called Force Troops. And force troops will service the needs of the reaction forces, but will also service the needs of what we're calling the adaptable force, which I'll come on to in a moment. Now, inside those force troops, what we've tried to do is to be much more joint in the way that we've integrated things. And we've also created or are creating an organization called a security assistance group, which will be the body that will provide the soft effect that I described earlier and will corral together the notion of media, psyops, civil affairs, those sorts of things, as a plug that can go into the divisional headquarters or lower levels if necessary. Now, the adaptable force. This is, I think, perhaps the next big idea, is this notion of adaptability. And it's our sense in an age of austerity that reserves are important, but it's the notion of being able to adapt much more readily as an army that will be important. And the idea behind the adaptable force is it's not necessarily a second echelon or a second tier. It is a collection of forces which will have more of a reserve component, but which will have a different task. And they will carry the shoulder of the security assistance that we require in the future. So they will be a very interesting place to serve. And that's where our expertise will be developed over time. They will also find our standing commitments. So they will find the deployments that we have in Cyprus at the moment, two battalions, one to become a battle group in the future, the Falkland Islands, and those sorts of garrisons that we require, as well as Brunei in the future. They will clearly be also looking towards the homeland and this notion of UK engagement and the national resilience that's required within the homeland and making the connection that is required there. And clearly they are there in the event of us being required to deliver for the nation something rather larger than the defence planning assumptions assume currently. And then last but by no means least, they will be trained up to a level where we will be able to ensure institutional readiness. And I think as you get down to the sorts of numbers that we're talking about, this notion of having institutional readiness is really, really important. Now, I talked about partnerships. And inside the adaptable force, 2/3 of our active duty infantry battalions will be located. Now, those infantry battalions will be smaller than the 1/3 in the reaction forces. They will be at about 570 in terms of their strength. And they will draw their resilience from the partnership that they will create with reserve infantry battalions, which will have on their books around 400 to 450 soldiers. And pooled together at readiness, the idea will be that they will be able to create a much larger infantry battalion. And that notion of partnership and integration is right at the core of what we want to do with this adaptable piece of the army. Now, clearly, this has been a process of rebalancing as well. And what we've tried to do, as all armies do on these occasions, is to get after the institutional overhead, you know, the so-called generating force, the piece that does, in a sense, the headquarters structure and the recruiting and all of the administrative and institutional functions that armies require. And we've managed, I think, to reduce it by not a great deal, but about 2 to 3%. It's not a bad achievement. What we have done, though, which may surprise you, is that we've gone back and examined what we call our resilience manning margins. And this is not a very sexy subject, but it's something that armies require. At least, I should think, 11% of the US Army is devoted to this notion of a resilience margin. And what we tried to do in the 90s was to cut this to make the inevitable saving that you make by reducing it. And we've suffered ever since. Because you have to have a margin to give you the flexibility to avoid gapping your regular component every time a new commitment comes up. But importantly, in the type of world that we're going to have to operate in the future, it provides you with the flexibility to send soldiers and officers out to do different and interesting things. It provides you with the wherewithal to connect to foreign armies, for example. And importantly, I think, given that the nature of the security in the environment in the future is going to be much more, I sense, about multi-agency security, it gives us the opportunity to attach soldiers to commerce or to business or to different sectors that are associated with security, because it's going to be a much more complex security environment in which we have to operate in 10 to 15 years' time. And therefore, the opportunity for soldiers to exchange and for others to come in and to have that strategic partnership with other sectors that are going to provide you with a much greater understanding of what you do in contextual terms is something that a margin allows you to do. And importantly, it also allows you, I think, which is really important in times of severe austerity, to do much more focused personal development. And the connection to academia which we look enviously at over here with so many of your fellowships at Harvard and so on and so forth, is something that we need to reinvent regardless of the cost, because it's the way in which we will continue to develop intellectually and develop the leaders that are going to be able to do the sorts of difficult things that are going to be required in innovative terms in the future. Now, pulling all of that together, I mean, there's some quite significant transformational ideas there. First big idea is this idea of adaptability. It's adaptability, first of all, about becoming a much more joined up learning organisation, something that we've had to do the hard way during the course of the last 4 or 5 years through the counterinsurgency battle that we've been involved in. But it's also related to that, being prepared to take the so what out of the learning organisation bit, and therefore routinely being prepared to change the structure. And of course, what one tends to do is to take your full structure and live with it until the next defence review. But what we've got to be prepared to do, if we're going to be agile enough and adaptable enough, is to revisit that structure, often on an annual basis, I guess, to ask whether or not it's the right structure for the nature of upcoming tasks. Secondly, it's about tactical adaptation. And we've all seen that on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan. There is that need continually to be trying to be one step ahead of your opponent. But it'll also be tactical adaptation when you're deployed on a security assistance task overseas and how it is that you're going to relate to that indigenous force. Experimentation as well. I think that it was Montgomery that said, as armies become very small, so much more of the premium needs to be placed on experimentation. And one of our reaction force brigades, of which there will be 3 armoured infantry ones, will be dedicated to experimentation on the 3-year cycle in which it will rotate through the system of readiness. And how that brigade is linked to industry, so that you end up with something that is genuinely developing cutting-edge type ideas, is work in progress and thought in progress. And then, of course, the notion of regeneration. I mean, we would all hope, wouldn't we, as military people, that we've got to the bottom in terms of the numbers. And it has to be said that one needs to think through how it is that you might regrow yourself in regenerative terms. So adaptability to regenerate is important. And then I think also adaptability to be able to operate in the alliances of the future. And here we've taken NATO very much as the underpinning basis on which we will operate in the future. Next big idea is on the notion of integrated. It's this idea of pulling the reserve into the regular structure in a way that is different. It is going to be extremely challenging in the UK because we don't, as I said earlier, have this culture of reserve service. And it will require us, I think, to create a series of frameworks of strategic partnerships with public and private sector employers. And those partnerships will help us, I think, in terms of developing people, but they're obviously going to be fundamental to provide the basis on which employers will deliver reserves more routinely than perhaps we've required in the past. We'll need to look at our basing plan and how that lays down, and you will know that you very quickly get into very difficult political discussions about where things live and where people do their business. But the basing plan has got to be linked to the civilian sector and to civilian capability so that we are able in the future to be able to deliver reserves in a way that make more sense. And then, of course, there's the business of making sure that the legislation is sufficiently flexible to allow the sorts of deployments that we need in the future. And the nettle is being grasped on all of this, and it's my sense that over the course of the next 6 months, there will be a government white paper that will address some of these issues. Now, what we haven't done, and we will need to do in the future, is to work out how the career structure, that vital parallel pyramid, meets and interrelates with the force structure. And the career structure is the next piece of work that needs to be done, I believe, personally, over the course of the next year or two. And that career structure has got to, given the size of the army of the future, take account of the army needing to be slightly more disciplined in its approach, the tribalism perhaps being suppressed at regimental level to allow the army to perhaps to be more disciplined in its approach above regimental level. But importantly, it's also got to be a career structure that is fit for purpose in the modern world and which is able to provide the wherewithal for somebody who's going to be an expert in cyber or somebody who's going to be an expert in East Africa genuinely to develop so that they can become the defence attachés of the future or whatever the pinnacle of that particular career stream might be. And at the moment, we have a career structure that was very much designed for the Cold War. It's one that has been tinkered with slightly to deliver for the current operations that we're involved in. But it is not a career structure that is, I sense, fit for purpose for the nature of the modern world that I've described during the course of what we think Army 2020 will be pitched at. I think I've probably talked for quite long enough. I'm very happy to hand back over to you, sir.
Thank you. Wait till my mic is on. There we go. That was a fascinating tour. In fact, I had 9 questions written down, and I think you actually answered all 9 of them, but luckily you raised quite a few more along the way. I would ask that those of you who have written questions, hold them up. The staff will collect them and get them up to Steve and to Nate. While you're doing that, let me ask you a couple things that I don't think you touched on much at all. One of the strengths of the British Army for almost forever has been training. And the ability to maintain training under virtually all circumstances. I didn't hear you touch much on that. How do you wrap in your training requirements and the funding and capability for those?
I think one of our starting points on this was that we wanted to slow down the pace of our training and readiness cycles to provide more time for training and to provide more time for training to settle down at every level in the chain of command. I mean, one of the features of what we've been doing as armies over the course of the last 5 years or so is it's been a very rapid hamster wheel of deployment. Mm-hmm. And there hasn't been the opportunity, in a sense, for the learning organisation and the training organisation to be able to do much more than just to service the needs of the hamster wheel. So what we've gone for is a cycle which is a 3-year cycle rather than what we've got at the moment, which is effectively a 2 to 2.5 year cycle, to provide more time for training and more time for the assimilation of the process at every level within the structure. Now, we are thinking very hard at the moment about where the best place is for the British Army to train in the future. I think most people agree that what is critical here is to try and make sure that we still develop the innovative leaders who are able to take on any problem and take it on in a way that is open-minded and approachable. I think that there will be a debate about whether the plains of Suffield are the right place to train the Army of the future, because maybe the terrain is not complex enough. And there'll be a debate about whether we'd be better off training in Europe or whether we should be training in the Middle East and maybe touching up our Arab allies to do that. The jury is still out. There's thinking going on. But the basic principle is that the training must still put pressure on individuals to develop the notion of innovation and the ability for leaders to still continue to be able to do it.
My second question, and I'll turn the mic over to my colleagues, has to do with modernization and the industrial base that's necessary to support this. Whenever one faces resource constraints and the trade-off is between force structure and modernization, this is a delicate balance to maintain both near-term and long-term. Was this really focused on a smaller army to meet a budget requirement, or did you actually take the army down even further in order to build the capacity to sustain modernization, research, and investment in technology downstream?
I mean, I think looking across defense as a whole, I think there's a sense that inevitably the ever-increasing personnel costs constrain what you can do in terms of the equipment and broader budgetary issues. And I think from the army's perspective, the reduction that we've taken has made it possible for Philip Hammond, the current Secretary of State for Defence, to be able to provide greater focus on certainly the armoured vehicle production line that goes with it. So I think there has been a trade-off. I think it'll take a while for the outcome of that trade-off to be delivered. But certainly if General Peter Wall was sitting here now, he is really quite upbeat about how he thinks his army of the future is now likely to be equipped on the basis of the way that this rebalancing has been affected.
That's a pretty critical trade-off. I mentioned earlier that we might learn from you about dead ends, but it may actually be that we learn a whole lot more about successful consideration. I'm particularly intrigued by the active reserve mix dynamic that you've fostered here, and I think we'll be watching that very closely. Steve and Nate, let me turn over to you, and you can raise some of the questions that you've collected there.
Well, thank you very much for your remarks. Very enlightening. One of the big questions, I think, that seems to be coming out from both the audience as well as one we anticipated asking as well is the SDR, the SDSR had a force sizing and shaping construct that sort of envisioned 3 bunches of potential contingency responses. There was, you know, the complex enduring, the non-complex enduring, et cetera. It seems that you've described sort of a capability that's slightly different than the SDSR construct as far as what the British Army at any given time could surge toward. I'd be very interested to hear What your thoughts are on sort of the surge capacity of the British Army as to what level, how many subunits, et cetera. And then finally, just to join on with that, do you intend on maintaining a three-star operational headquarters capability as well? So those are...
Hey, thanks for that, Nate. The answer is that all armies are, in a sense, are sized and shaped by their defense policy. And the size and shape of the British Army falls absolutely out of the defense planning assumptions that you listed. And what the British Army needs to be able to do, or in a sense, I say the British Army, it's the land environment needs to be able to do, is to be able to meet three different contingencies. Contingency one is the ability simultaneously to be able to do a battle group size complex intervention. Now, typically, that'll either be done by one of the battle groups that I described at the tip of the spear, or it might be done by a special forces component. The second requirement is simultaneously is to be able to do a simple intervention, and that typically is something like a non-combatant evacuation, where the threat is rather less, and it's obviously going to be a smaller joint contribution as a consequence. And then all of that at the same time as being able to sustain a brigade-level enduring commitment. Numbers can be discussed, but I don't know, sort of 5,000 to 6,000 sort of people, that sort of structure. So that is what the structure is aimed for. And then, of course, what you have to do is you have to take a view on what your sustainability rates are going to be, what dwell time you've got, and all of that good stuff. And I think that this is a dog that didn't bite, but personally, I think that we will have to think very hard about deployment times and dwell times. I'm not necessarily convinced that the machine that currently generates people on the basis of 24/6 in terms of months in dwell time and 6 deployed is necessarily the best method of dealing with the very complex environments that we're currently serving in. But that, you know, you have to take a view on the task first of all. Now, the second contingency is sort of, in a sense, more of the same, but it's about being able to do three interventions at once at battle group level, whilst not doing an enduring operation. And then the third one, which is the bit that's really interesting, of course, is what they call, at best effort, being able to field a division of three brigades. Now, you're not resourced for best effort. What best effort is at a particular moment in readiness terms, you know, it's all hands to the pump, pull together all of the force structure, strip out what you've got, and take a view on what you can deliver. Sort of what happens every time we get an invasion of Iraq or whatever else it might be. And that a bit, of course, when you're redesigning an army, is the bit that you want to focus on first of all. And it was fascinating discussing in academia and in policy-making circles, what did people think they really wanted from the army of the future, and how important was this notion of best effort? And I think the thing that struck me most was it's this ability to be able to field a division, probably as part of a coalition and almost certainly American construct, whilst being able to take on board a brigade from elsewhere in multinational terms within that division. Now, the trick, of course, is how quickly you can do that. And the reality I sense is that, you know, unless it really is all hands to the pump and industry throws itself at it and all the other sustainability issues are solved, you're talking about no sooner than a year in terms of readiness to be able to conduct that sort of best effort type output. But it is not something that is costed, because it is not something that we are resourced specifically to do. We're resourced to do the two former contingencies, and then you make the best of what you possibly can from what's available to you to deliver the output that I've described. But I think it's really important that, as an army, we continue to think like that, because the exponential difference between operating at the brigade tactical level and what you do at the divisional level and above is so great. Now, we also can see that happening inside the ARC. And the ARC remains absolutely vital to the British Army's commitment in land environment terms. How it will be used in the future, I suspect increasingly people would regard it as being much more the sort of deployment that the ARC did in 05-06 in Afghanistan, where it's at the theatre level and it's providing the basis of a joint task force that pulls it together. The extent to which we will do, manoeuvre in a core context in the future, you can think about it, but I suspect it's not something that we would see happening imminently. But the ARC is a very important construct in that respect.
Yes, General, one other set of issues that you didn't address was the role of special operations forces and how they would be integrated with conventional forces. If you could touch on that in the British context, but also your armed forces have played an important role in the development of this NATO special operations headquarters. A British brigadier, I think, serves as the deputy commander of that, which is a NATO framework organization. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you saw lessons learned in that context, too, in NATO's development of an integration of special operations forces.
Yeah, I suspect that General Tony Thomas, a great American who's trying to pull it together in ISAF at the moment, is learning an awful lot of lessons on the hoof. The answer is that I think what we have learned during the course of the last sort of 5 or 7 years of counterinsurgency is that many of the tasks that formerly would have been tasks that we'd have dedicated to special forces have had to be done by conventional infantry. And whilst they are not resourced and equipped to be able to do those sorts of tasks in the way that special forces are, I think that some of the perhaps intellectual barriers between the outputs of those organisations have been broken down. And I think that the average infantry company commander now is much more likely to be able to do the sorts of tasks that perhaps we would have very much fixed to special forces. Now, I think that where we go with our special forces in the future is a really interesting issue. And the extent to which we resource them to be able to deliver the sorts of outputs that are going to be required in the future, which we've assumed as a result of Iraq and Afghanistan are always going to be available, I think is something we're going to have to think quite hard about. And I'm not going to go into the detail of it, but it's the ISR that they require, the nature of the aviation to deliver the output, and all of that are areas where we are going to have to think quite hard about how we do all of that. Because we should be in no doubt that we continue to deliver extremely able people into the special forces. And I suspect they are a bellwether of the quality of our army and a bellwether of the quality of our Marines, that we continue to deliver such effective people. I think how closely we work together has also been a feature of the last 5 to 7 years of operations. And I do think that, again, a number of barriers have been broken down in terms of the relationship between conventional forces and special forces. And I know that's the case in the US forces as well.
Steve, could you indulge me to follow on to that question? Your comment, General, about training indigenous forces and adding value strikes me as something that America could learn very much from you. We just completed a study looking at the Pacific and what our new strategic rebalancing, and the idea of greater engagement, of course, is a prominent feature of that. It strikes me that using diaspora as a mechanism there creates the opportunity for very special forces that are almost unique in that regard. I think it's quite a lot we can learn as you implement that. Back to you. Yeah.
Just to embellish on that, because we did have a question from the audience about that and on the issue of use of the diaspora in security assistance and how, as the question said, how do you ensure that this support is pure, that is, it is faithful to UK objectives and not self-serving of maybe some of the individuals that you might be drawing upon or who are perhaps exiled for reasons and trying to settle scores, I guess is the implicit
Yeah, and there will inevitably be all sorts of challenges, and it's always been very difficult for us to recruit from the ethnic minorities. I mean, interestingly, and people may be surprised by the statistics I'm about to give you, come 2020, the cohort whence our army or our armed forces recruit from, the 15 to 23-year-olds, will be 25% from ethnic minorities. If you go to a town like Blackburn at the moment, up in the northwest of England, you'll find a population of about 130,000, of which 80,000 will be from AFPAC, with British residency and British status. Now, those sorts of sizes of populations are populations that are, you know, issues we've got to really think about. Now, the extent to which our police force finds it possible to engage with them, given that these minorities tend to regard police forces as predatory organisations rather than supportive organisations, is difficult. And this uniform is much more likely to be able to break down barriers and knock on the doors of madrasas and mosques to be able to connect the, as it were, the population together. So I think that it's this aspect, it's the sort of softer aspect of it, which is the bit that is helpful in terms of getting after some of the de-radicalisation agendas that need to be supported. I think also picking up your point on, you know, this notion of security assistance. I mean, this is, I think, going to be something that we all do in the future. Now, it has obviously been something in your terms that has been described as FID, and it's been a soft requirement. It's been a soft task. I don't think we can afford to do that in the future. I think it's got to become everybody's business. The challenge, of course, is the propensity for risk. And when you start to deploy these security assistance forces in places where the risk stakes go up, inevitably you start to get into the special forces domain. So it's that balance of risk versus output, which I think people and policymakers will have to think about before they deploy them.
We have a number of questions on reserve forces, so I'm going to try and collect them together. First, there's a very specific question on using the Israeli Army's model of reserve and active integration. But more broadly, I think the question I would ask is, what other models did you examine as far as integrating reserve and active forces? Also, as you get the reserves more involved in sort of the total force, how are you acculturating that or socializing that with employers who may have more demands on the reserve forces that we found, obviously, here in the United States? The final point, and I think this is very interesting in reading the 2020 document, are the reserve forces now sort of more an operational reserve than they are a strategic reserve? Are they in spite of the fact that they're more involved in the adaptable forces, are they in fact, should they be more ready for more higher intensity combat operations or more intense operations abroad?
Yeah, I'll take that one first. I think it's our sense that we are going to need to have to use them routinely. So going back to those defence planning assumptions, if we are going to be committed to an enduring brigade-sized operation, whatever dwell time to deployment time you place upon it, by about the third or fourth rotation, you've probably got between 15 and 20% of that force coming from the active reserve. So pretty quickly you're getting into fairly significant numbers. Now, yes, they're going to be fulfilling the functions that I've described, which are predominantly in the logistic area and the specialisms, but they are nonetheless going to be from the reserve component. Now, that is going to bring great challenges with the relationship with employers. And, of course, employers are going to need to understand, understand the outset, what advantage they're getting from this. And I think it's this notion of how it is that an individual is a shared resource for the mutual benefit of ourselves and also for the employer, which is the bit that we've got, the trick that we've got to finesse. And I know it's something that you're wrestling with over here as well. I'm an optimist. I think it is possible to do that because I do think that what the armed forces in the UK bring to the outside world in civilian and public employer terms is really quite significant. And I think that the Olympics were a very good demonstration of this. And I think that a lot of people who perhaps hadn't had a close association with the armed forces in the past saw what the armed forces did at the Olympics and can see that a collection of very able people are very valuable. So I happen to think we can make this work, but I'm in no doubt it's going to be very challenging. And the extent to which employers have become used to being compensated when an individual is deployed is something that we're also going to have to try and get over, because at the moment, reserves are cheap to have, but my word, they're expensive to employ. And that is a paradigm that we can't really live with in the future. Now, who did we study and what did we look at in terms of best practice? Well, we've got an Australian in the room. We went to Australia, or we didn't go there, sadly, but we looked at what the Australians have done. And, of course, I happen to think that Australian personnel policies are always way ahead of anybody else's, actually. So if anybody's trying to do this sort of work, go and look at what the Australians have done. Now, they tried to develop hybrid units, and they experimented with reserve infantry battalions being connected into regular infantry battalions in a genuinely integrated and hybrid organisation. And we looked at that, but the Australians learned pretty quickly that you were trying to resolve predominantly different cultures, because, of course, you've got the active duty component who wants to work 5 days a week and have his weekend off, and then you've got the reserve who wants to work at evenings and at a weekend, and how you rationalise that is really difficult to do. So there are all sorts of low-level practical issues that have to be resolved, which is why we went for what, in fact, they've gone for now, which is this idea of partnership. So you've got a commanding officer of a regular outfit sitting alongside a commanding officer of a reserve outfit, and they work it out between them how they are going to operate in cultural terms. We also looked at Canadians, and we clearly looked at American model as well. And I think with all of these models, it fundamentally comes back to culture. And it is what is going to be acceptable to the culture in your country. So you end up invariably looking at these things, but you ultimately have to go back to what is your own perspective and your own way of doing business. And the UK is particular in that regard.
General, we had a question related to, you mentioned the British Army's support to Olympic security, and more broadly, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about special considerations that you looked at in developing Army 2020 with regard to support to resilience missions at home, and particularly specialized missions where the Army has the capacity in counter chemical, biological, radiological threats, other kinds of specialized intervention against terrorist activity, how you saw the Army fitting in this, and how 2020 is reflective of some of these future requirements.
Yeah, I mean, I talked a bit about taking savings from the institutional overhead. One of the things that we have done as part of the process of repatriating from Germany over time is that the homeland command and control structure is now very much the adaptable forces command and control structure. So a brigade headquarters in northeast England will have a range of different tasks, one of which will be at readiness to be able to provide a brigade headquarters, perhaps to go and be part of the enduring operation. Another at readiness will be perhaps to provide an infantry brigade headquarters to be, I know, a manoeuvre support element in a divisional deployment. But importantly, on a day-to-day basis, what that brigade headquarters will do will be to link into the homeland security aspect of northeast England. And that brigade headquarters will therefore need to understand the contingencies that the civilian contingent piece has in its on its inventory. Now, again, we need to be sort of sensible and circumspect about what the army will do and what expectation we deliver. We are not in the business, frankly, of achieving, if people are experts on British history, another sort of Peterloo-type massacre. We do not see the armed forces being used in that sort of military aid to the civil power. But we do absolutely see the armed forces being involved in providing the ability perhaps for the police force to be backfilled, for the police force to go and take part in civil disorder or whatever it might be. And we absolutely see the army being available to help with flooding, with natural disasters and all of that. But there's a fine balance to be struck in constitutional terms, in terms of how the British Army is involved in all of that, or our armed forces are involved in all of that, and we need to be circumspect and sensible about it. But we will continue to provide specialisms, and you touched on some of them, and the business of explosive ordnance disposal is something that the Army provides a great deal of support to the civil disaster structure. And we'll also continue to be able to provide capabilities when it comes to the sort of nuclear, biological, chemical area, but I won't go into the detail of it just here.
General, to what extent do you think that remote and unmanned systems will play a role in British Army 2020 going forward?
These are good questions, because they're filling out all the areas that I might have talked to if I had 2 hours to talk on. The answer is that I talked about, you know, winners and losers in terms of the active duty component, in terms of the size of it. And I talked about, you know, losers in the logistic area and losers in the sort of dumb gunnery area. Some of the winners, though, in terms of our Royal Artillery area, have been the ISR area. And we have invested significantly, or we will invest significantly, we have done in structural terms, in two regiments now that will deliver unmanned aerial vehicles at the divisional level. hitherto, we'd have had one of these regiments. We now are going to have two, and we are going to grow it to be able to integrate the notion of UAVs, the Watchkeeper program, at divisional level. Where we've also done more in terms of the Royal Artillery is that we've absolutely understand the need for integration in terms of effect on the battlefield. And rather than perhaps what we would have done 10 years ago, which is just simply talk about forward observation officers and all of that artillery type structure, what we've done now is to adjust the Royal Artillery structure to deliver these teams that are able to integrate much more sophisticated capabilities at the battle group and brigade level.
General, turning back to a cooperation with key allies. I wondered, we had a question from the audience, and we also had some thoughts on, we're interested in hearing more of your thoughts about how you see the status of your cooperation with the French, in particular some of the agreements reached under the Lancaster House framework, particularly the operationalizing this joint combined expeditionary task force that was a key element of that. It seems that this will bring about some demands for real changes in the way the UK thinks about coalition warfare, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that and how you see those kinds of operations being organized in the future.
I mean, I think importantly, all that we've sought to do with our relationship with the French has been based upon the sort of NATO context. And I mean, what's very impressive about the French approach to this, I think, is how they've they've embraced NATO doctrine and NATO procedures in a way that I suspect that we paid a bit of lip service to ourselves from a few years ago. Now, I think that has therefore provided the basis on which our partnership with the French will endure. Now, in terms of that partnership, of course, what we've done is, as you described, is to create this combined joint task force. And it's going to be exercised in terms of not a formal FTX, but the notion of command post exercises and all of that during the course of the next 18 months or so. And we've learned some great lessons from our early contacts on this in terms of language and communication and sharing information and all of that. And it's only, I think, through that process of working together and trying to share the information that you learn really where your weaknesses are. And I think that we've beginning to develop some quite sensible procedures with them, which will stand us in very good stead for whoever it is who's going to be our partner within that NATO context. Now, the other area where we're leaning heavily into them is that some of their training facilities are admirable when it comes to the notion of complex terrain and the urban environment. And SENSUB, which is their urban training facility, is something that we've now begun to pump our subunits and battle groups in due course through at a much greater rate than we've done in the past. And I think this idea of training in that way will be very complementary to what I talked about earlier in response to the question about training. And indeed, a lot of their soldiers have come across the UK and have trained in the areas which I think we're quite good at, which is the notion of field and live firing, which has always been at the heart of what our armed forces have done. And I think they've learned a great deal from that sort of interaction with us. I think it's a work in progress, and it's something that both armies have lent into significantly, and it's proving to be quite profitable at the lower tactical level, and I think in due course will be very profitable at the combined joint task force level.
In some ways, what that does is it actually holds out a better model for NATO and the other allies as well, and I think that's very potentially very promising.
Well, in fact, David, I was going to ask the general if you've seen, have you seen interest of other European countries in wanting to participate in some of this kind of activity on the idea that it, indeed, as I understood it initially, there was some thought, at least on the French side, that this might inspire others to look at what you were doing and see how they could also contribute to have greater effect in the overall integration of alliance forces.
Yes, and I mean, I think if General Peter Wall was sitting here, he'd be the first to say that, because we're developing this relation with the French, it doesn't mean that we're throwing all other relationships out. I mean, absolutely, fundamentally not. And, we still have a very close relationship with the German army. And indeed, with so much of the British army based in Germany, there is that very close connection in doctrine and procedural terms. So the answer, I think, to your question is yes. It's a question of time and resources. And of course, training is expensive. But what I think one learns from this process is the more that you operate together, in a sense, the more resource efficient it becomes.
I think if you all have a couple more, we'll do two more, and then I'll do a final one, and we'll wrap
up. Well, actually, the general just led right into a great question I was going to ask about. Apropos this comment of resources is smart defense and the NATO concepts of smart defense, some of the initiatives that Allied Command Transformation has come up with. I wondered how, General, that whole sort of construct figured in as you looked at the Army 2020 structure and plans and some of the specific capabilities that you might see the UK Army would the British Army would benefit from some aspects of smart defense should some of these projects go forward.
I mean, the straight answer is it was some distance down the list because we were wrestling with how it is that we would become more effective in terms of the integration of the joint space and the interagency space first and foremost, and then of course how in pure tactical terms we would integrate the multinational element of it, and the divisional headquarters of the future, and we're overhauling our divisional headquarters as a result of this process, are going to be much more integrated beasts than they ever were in the past. And the way in which air planning, for example, as a capability will be plugged into it is very different to what our current divisional headquarters have in the light of the lessons that we've learned over the last sort of 2 to 3 years. So I think, I mean, the straight answer is, in terms of smart defence and how that played into the Army 2020's overall structure, not yet.
General, thank you again for taking the opportunity to come here and speak with us. I have one last question, and it's particular to your experience over the last decade, as well as sort of our collective experience with our two countries overseas and overseas operations. How specifically do you think the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have impacted the British Army and the way you now are taking the British Army forward? And I'd like you to reflect a little bit on both your experience as well as sort of how that experience is blended into the future of the British Army.
I mean, going right back to my sort of underpinning remarks that fell out of the Venn diagram. And in terms of force development, I think it's about, first of all, having appreciation of what you think the threat's going to look like in the future. Now, one of the great challenges that we had in designing Army 2020 is there's no obvious existential threat to the United Kingdom at the moment. You know, you went out and talked to a member of the public, they would find it quite difficult to work out what you want an army for. So that's a really quite important issue. But taking that and putting it to one side, it's this notion, I think, of the hybrid threat, which is, if you like, taking the worst bit out of the nature of the Taliban insurgent on the one hand, with the sorts of capabilities that come with state near peer competitors, putting that together into a melee of hybridity, which you then need to be able to compete against. Now, I think you have to be really careful what lessons you do draw from Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, we have bred a generation of soldiers now who would claim that they really understand combat, and in all sorts of ways they really do understand combat in a way that at our, you know, when we were young, we didn't understand it. But it's a particular sort of combat, you know, and the notion of the what we call the Helmand snake, you know, the infantry patrol of 14 people trogging along behind each other, which is the way you operate in Helmand or Kandahar, is not the structure and the shape of how you need to maneuver against the hybrid adversary that I've described. So I think you have to be really careful how you do it. And I think all our armies are going to have to go through an evolutionary loop that takes the best or the worst, if you like, of what we've been up against in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, and translates it into the nature of the threat of the future, which fundamentally will require us to integrate and maneuver in a way that is different to what we've done in Afghanistan. And to my mind, that's going to be the bit that will be challenging, because a lot of these youngsters don't necessarily believe that that's what the future is going to be like. You know, they're much more likely to think the future is as they've confronted it in Helmand or Kandahar or Paktika.
My final question, sir, has to do, I was very impressed with your comment as you were describing the process at the focus on implementation that you brought to bear throughout this. And all too often, we find ourselves wrestling and coming up with good ideas and then asking the question, okay, how do we do that? And you seem to have brought that as part of the process. But the one of the keys of implementation is who's the champion inside. Now, you've finished this, you've handed it off, you've dropped the ball on that, and somebody else has picked it up. How do you create the champion and sustain the champion over time? How did you wrestle with that question?
Well, the champion is General Peter Wall. I mean, I, you know, worked very closely with him, and all of the thinking that has underpinned what we've eventually delivered is thinking that he absolutely shares. And he's an engineer, and you'll know that engineers will not cross a bridge until they've worked out how the bridge is constructed. And every bit of the detailed logic flow that has ended up with Army 2020 being announced as it has is a journey that he's lived. Right. And as the head of the army, he has to be the champion of this. Right. Now, at the two-star level, there are three two-stars who are responsible for implementing different bits of it. And the chap who's got the hardest challenge is Kevin Abraham, who's dealing with the sort of strategic partnerships, reserves, and all of that stuff. I mean, the sort of, you know, the O&D implementation is relatively straightforward to do. But it is the head of the army who's the champion of this. And if General Peter was sitting here now, he would be advocating in exactly the same way as I've been talking about it. And that is, that I think is the great thing about this. Hopefully there's a sort of seamlessness about how it's going to be taken forward over the next 18 months.
Well, you've given us this morning quite a remarkable and penetrating insight into both the process and the dynamics, as well as the results and the thinking. And we're extremely grateful for that. We'll be watching this very closely. I would encourage you, as you're looking to invest your future soldiers in an academic environment, that you consider sending one as a fellow to the Center for Strategic International Studies. We'd be happy to host one. I also owe you a bit of an apology. I note that even though the British Armed Forces are far more accomplished than we are at being joint, we inadvertently left an extra line at the end of your biography in our brochure this morning that not only indicates that you're taking over ISAF, but also the command of the U.S. 7th Fleet. And that's a level of jointness to which we may aspire, but we have not yet achieved. On behalf of our sponsor, Rolls-Royce of North America, and on behalf of CSIS, I want to thank you for joining us this morning. I want to thank all of you for being here as well. Thank you very much.